You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, January 29th, 2014, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hey!
And Evan Bernstein.
Only slightly under the weather, but I am here. Good evening,
everyone.
How is everyone doing?
I'm good. I got three vaccines in the past week.
Did you?
Oh, wow.
I finally got my flu shot. And I was talking
to...
I'm at the pharmacy in the supermarket. Like, I have a basket that has milk, bread, eggs, and cheese. Literally. And I'm like,
so
oh my
cliche.
God. I know. It's like, it was coming up on 6 o'clock and I'm like, there it is. It's right there. I'm not sick. I'm doing it. So I go in and I'm like, hey, I think I'll get my flu shot. So there was a guy standing there and, she goes, I only have 13 left. And the guy goes, I don't want 13. And I'm like thinking, is he serious? Whatever. So I go, look, I'm happy to take 13. Like, let's do it. Right. So I get in there. So then I got the flu shot.
Wait. You mean the number 13?
She only had 13 left out of all
13
the
doses.
Yeah. Okay.
13 doses left.
Oh, I see. This is Triskaidekaphobia.
But at least the guy was there to get his flu shot. So then
I thought you meant you would take 13 vaccines. Never mind. Okay. I'm caught up now.
Sorry. I wasn't
there. You only need one, Jay.
I know. You almost
give me all those shots. Give me every flu shot. So what happened is I said, what other shots do you have available? I have a newborn. So she's like, well, we could give you the Tdap, which is the pertussis shot, and we can also give you tetanus. I'm like, I'll take them all. Let's do it. She's like, really? I'm like, yeah. I'm like, can you do them all on one arm? She goes, I don't recommend it.
Tetanus is usually included in the Tdap.
You're actually right. They did come together, Rebecca. You're very smart.
Did you ask for extra mercury?
I did. Yeah. I said, look, I work for a pharmaceutical company, so I want extra mercury. And I'm making tons of money off of the payback, which is so awesome.
And now you have autism.
I do.
Somebody had to say it.
All right. Well, Rebecca, tell us what's special about today.
Today is the birthday of Lydia Maria Adams DeWitt. Hooray!
Of course.
Happy birthday.
February 1st, 1859. DeWitt did, she was a doctor. She earned her Doctor of Medicine in 1898.
That's impressive.
Yeah. Her Bachelor of Science in 1899 at the University of Michigan, both of them. And she did some very important research in pathology, and particularly she studied the pathology of tuberculosis and helped work on chemotherapy for tuberculosis. She was excluded from the University of Michigan Faculty Research Club because she was a woman. And so she founded and headed up the Women's Research Club, which she started in 1902 and which I believe still exists today and exists as a way to help women in the sciences at University of Michigan. The other fun fact about DeWitt is that she was featured in the very first edition of the biographical catalog American Men of Science for her work in microscopic anatomy and neuroanatomy.
Oh, awesome. Okay.
So yeah, the first edition of American Men of Science, but for some reason it took American Men of Science until the 1970s to change their name to American Men and Women of Science. But So happy birthday, Lydia Maria Adams DeWitt.
Yeah, it's cool. You know, the work she did in tuberculosis didn't lead directly to a cure. I mean, obviously that didn't come until antibiotics much later, but it did sort of set the stage for later development.
Yep.
TB was it's one of those things that's not really on the radar very much in public consciousness, right? You guys ever worry about TB?
Never.
Well, in hospitals.
But, you know, outside of hospitals, I never hear people, nobody asks me about it, so it doesn't seem like it's one of those things. But before antibiotics, there were entire hospitals dedicated to warehousing people with TB. I mean, it was a major, major illness, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And it still is a problem. It's starting to work its way back because of multiple antibiotic-resistant strains.
Steve, what are the symptoms? What does it do to you, and can it kill you?
Yeah, it gives you a chronic pneumonia, essentially. So people will have like this chronic cough that never seems to go away. And it's a wasting disease. You know, it used to be called consumption.
Yeah.
You know, and people would it's get thought really to be what people suspected vampires were ages ago, because you would just sort of waste away to nothing. And so it was thought that magical powers were somehow draining the blood and the health from otherwise perfectly healthy people.
There could be other complications. It could infect other organ systems as well. All right. Well, we're going to start this week with a special report rather than a news item. A year ago, we talked about the Edge annual question and for 2013, and we're going to do it again this year. The 2014 question is, what scientific idea is ready for retirement? And they asked, or they got responses from 175 people. These are supposed to be smart people to see what they think about it. It seems like
they are smart people.
I think a lot of them
most
are.
Most of them are.
A lot of scientists and professors, and you know, I think a lot of I noticed a lot of them are have written a book. A lot of them are book authors, and so that's probably partly how they found, you know, the people to ask. But I thought this, you know, it was a very provocative question. It almost invited weird answers.
Yeah, I agree. You
know? But they I don't know, I found the answers to be sure. really repetitive and dull. Like, most of them were either essentialism or humans as some sort of special species above and beyond.
Yeah, I thought the question invited straw men.
Yeah.
Know, so people wanted to get rid of something that isn't really accepted within science anyway, you know. So that was one theme that cropped out. I think the worst, I actually blogged about what I thought was the worst example of that.
Was it the atheism one?
Scientific method?
Yeah. And, you know, I see what the scientific method essay was going for, this idea that crowdsourcing is sort of the wave of the future, but it's so dumb to squeeze that into this idea that the scientific method should just be retired. Like,
yeah.
What? No. You obviously do not know what you're talking about if you're suggesting that.
Yeah. Right. So some of them were things that were one of the themes that crept up were just like that. Like they said, like this idea isn't all it's cracked up to be, so we should just get rid of it. When in fact, no one relies solely on that in any case. Another example of that kind of straw man was getting rid of the idea that all evolution is entirely due to natural selection.
Oh, yeah.
It's like, yeah, that's not really what evolutionary biologists think. But the one that I thought was a huge straw man was getting rid of Occam's razor or the parsimony. Application of the principle of parsimony within mm-hmm. medicine. This
I
was
didn't
done.
See that one.
This was Gerald Smallberg, who is actually a practicing neurologist. Essentially, he got it wrong, and we've talked about Occam's razor in the past. So Occam's razor is often presented or interpreted as if there's multiple possible solutions to a question or a problem, multiple possible hypotheses to explain data, that the simplest is the most likely to be true and should be preferred.
It's really the one with the fewest assumptions.
Yeah, it's not the simplest. It's that you don't want to introduce new assumptions unnecessarily. I wrote about this week on Neurological, if you want to read really deep into it. But essentially I think the bottom line is that you want to minimize what I call the total assumption burden. So it's not just the number of assumptions, but it's also the magnitude of those assumptions. For example, within medicine, it may be better to introduce two or three diagnoses to explain a patient's symptoms if they're very common diagnoses, or the patient has risk factors for them, or they're a chain of causality. You know what I mean? Like obesity causes diabetes, causes neuropathy, causes ataxia. So I just gave the person four diagnoses, but they all flow from one to the next, as opposed to one really rare disease. It's fewer diagnoses, but a rare disease is a huge assumption burden, because there's, you know, the base rate is so low, or the prior probability could be so low. Whereas giving somebody a few very common likely things is not a big deal. So that's the point he was making, that patients can have lots of diagnoses and therefore Occam's razor doesn't apply in medicine. But that's because he was completely misinterpreting Occam's razor.
Steve, that was a very good deconstruction, but yeah. The dumbest essay was definitely Douglas Rushkoff's The Atheism Prerequisite, without a doubt.
Yeah, I agree. Okay. That was horrible.
Douglas Rushkoff is arguing that the scientific idea that's ready for retirement is starting from the idea that there is no God. Mm-hmm. It's like saying science is ruined because we're starting from the idea that there are no unicorns.
Yeah.
Like, no, you know, we start with nothing and we follow the evidence. Like, what he wrote literally made me slap myself in the forehead. Science's unearned commitment to materialism has led us into convoluted assumptions about the origins of space-time, in which time itself simply must be accepted as a byproduct of the Big Bang, and consciousness, if it even exists, as a byproduct of matter. First of all, no! Like, the time as a byproduct of the Big Bang, like, there are scientists who are studying what happened before the Big Bang. That is research that is ongoing and is remarkably interesting. And for him to just dismiss it as, well, everybody just assumes. No. Such narratives follow information on its continuing evolution toward complexity, the singularity, and robot consciousness, a saga no less apocalyptic than the most literal interpretations of biblical prophecy. I feel like even skeptics who are Christians or other theists realize how completely ridiculous that is. You don't start with the idea that there is a God and go from there. You start with the evidence and follow it to its natural conclusion.
Yeah. But that's also just another way of trying to argue against methodological naturalism, which is a prerequisite of the scientific method, of scientific methodology. You need some kind of cause and effect. You can't just introduce magic. You know, you say, well, we're assuming magic doesn't exist. It's like, well, no, science actually requires that magic is not part of the formulation because it's not falsifiable and it doesn't work. So, but I agree. I was reading through them and there were several times where like that, no, that's the dumbest one. And then when I got to that, I was like, no, that's the dumbest
that's
one.
Yeah. Yeah.
Someone else said falsifiability should be phased out as well.
Oh, yeah. God, speaking I missed that.
Which, yeah.
Yeah, pretty much every aspect of science.
Not all of them. I found one that I agreed with, or at least agreed with the.
Oh, yeah. No, premise. I found a few that I found.
One that I liked was maybe not getting rid of the term habitable zone, but more.
Habitable.
The habitable zone.
I think habitable is acceptable.
So what he said was it's more accurate, or at least the perception of what that means, or the Goldilocks zone, you know, like the sweet spot where we want a planet to be size-wise and distance from its star. You know, like there's a bunch of variables. But he was saying, you know, we should really can call it the liquid water belt, which I agree with. I think that's more accurate. Now, we could find life on planets that don't quote-unquote live in a Goldilocks zone, which is a loose definition. Like there could be life on Europa as an example, right? That's not in any kind of nice zone for humans. No, definitely not a liquid water belt type of planet for human life, but it is life. It is something that we are looking for. We are curious about.
Europa though, Jay, also points out that even the liquid water belt, it may not be accurate because if there's liquid water under the surface of Europa, it would be outside of Earth's liquid water zone, but because it's close to a large, you know, Jovian planet, and because of just the way the planet is constituted, you know, it could have liquid water.
And the tidal forces.
Yeah, tidal forces, et cetera.
Yeah, I don't think it could be a specific. It's got to be this. The liquid zone is this specific distance from this type of star. I think it's pretty much a case-by-case basis, like with Europa and other moons. I mean, if there's tidal forces that create heat, then bam, the sun's out of the equation. The sun is irrelevant.
And also, I mean, think about the difference between the Earth and Venus, you know, the greenhouse effect. I mean, you have to – there may be a tremendously wide variation of climate on different planets that might dramatically extend that zone. So there's a lot of assumptions that go into the liquid water or the habitable zone. And I think that – so I agree. I liked that essay. At least it was addressing the fact that there are these assumptions. I'm not done talking about ones I didn't like, though. I have to mention Dean Ornish wants to get rid of large randomized controlled trials.
I thought that was ridiculous as well. Okay. Yeah.
It was ridiculous. And because he was whining about the, oh, a large trial didn't show my diet is good, so I don't like it. But, it's ridiculous. Again, he does this, it's the Nirvana fallacy. You guys familiar with the Nirvana fallacy?
Oh, no.
No.
It's like it's when you listen to 1990s grunge bands.
That is cool. Not a fallacy. Good sense.
No, so it's when you say that because this thing isn't perfect, it's worthless.
Yes.
You're right.
Yeah. And so he's talking about all of the limitations of randomized controlled trials. And, you know, some of the, what he's saying is it's like, okay, that's right. That those are challenges to doing a good rigorous trial, but they're not insurmountable. Then he wants to throw the baby out with the bathwater and say, therefore we should like not do them. They're too expensive and you have to make all these compromises. Every study's a compromise. He wants to do small studies. Those are compromises too. You compromise the power of the study in order to be able to dedicate more resources to each subject within the study. There is a science and an art to designing an optimal trial to answer the question that you're going for. And just making some broad brushstroke statement like we should get rid of large randomized controlled trials is ridiculous. And the other one that was in that same vein was Gary Klein. He wants to get rid of evidence-based medicine. And because we don't,
for a lot of the same reasons,
we don't need no stinking evidence. Yeah, it's the same Nirvana fallacy, because evidence, because he's essentially said, get this, because we don't have perfect infinite knowledge.
Right. He says the science behind best practices is infallible and comprehensive, and that's certainly not the case with evidence-based medicine.
It would have to be infallible and comprehensive in order to be worthwhile. So if we don't know everything infallibly, then we should just forget the whole idea of evidence.
Well, how far do you take that though, Steve? And I don't mean to get personal with this guy.
It's already pretty far.
But how about you turn that same sentiment on yourself? Like, you're worthless because you're infallible and not perfect and unlimited.
That's the best response. Fallible. You're worthless.
No, but it's implied in his statement. I mean.
Yeah, but it's just kind of, it's a anything goes kind of mentality. It's like nothing's better than anything else. You know, we could do whatever we want. And he's basically saying we should let practitioners shoot from the hip and go with their instinct and their experience and not be tied to standards and best practices that are based upon
evidence.
Sounds like
Jenny McCarthy.
I know.
Yeah, it's ridiculous.
Because of pseudoscientists, I hate the word instincts now. You know, it's like the dirty word. No, as a matter of fact,
you should retire the idea of instincts.
Of instincts, thank you. I was trying to get there, Rebecca. Thanks.
Oh, boy. There were a lot of, Bob, I'm sure a lot of quantum mechanics cropped up.
Yeah.
We should get rid of the uncertainty principle. Kai Krauss said that.
Yeah, well, I mean,
I didn't quite get it.
His point was interesting in that it stemmed the name uncertainty principle stems from a mistranslation.
Yeah, but who cares?
I know it was an interesting little factoid from history, and he had that that analogy with Mongolian language and things, and it was okay. Yeah, my sense was like it was like kind of like big deal, you know, like how has that impacted, you know, the advance of quantum mechanics? I mean, is it really like hindered it in some way just because of that? And I think the original translation was of Schrodinger was like, what was it? Non-sharpness, you know, it was kind of a weird word that there's no real great analog in English, I guess.
Two people said we need to get rid of left brain, right brain, and I completely agree.
Yeah.
And one person said,
that's your left brain talking.
Yeah. Steve. And one person said that we need to get rid of brain, the notion of brain modules, which I also agree. These are all related. So essentially what they're saying is that there's no place in the brain where one thing happens. This is the network versus module debate. You know, is the brain a bunch of different little pieces that are each doing one thing, or is it organized as networks? You know, each network, which is an array of connections doing a certain thing. And it's actually both.
I was going to say, is that a false dichotomy?
Yeah, there are networks of modules, but because of that, and because, you know, there are these networks span the two hemispheres, that's why you can't say like this is all happening in the left hemisphere, because pathways in the brain are bilateral. And, you know, if you're looking at like fMRI scans of brain function and trying to discover the neurocorrelates of whatever, you often find that the same piece of the brain can engage in multiple different networks doing different things at different times. So again, I thought they, yes, we should get rid of all those things, but I thought that we already have. And I again filed that under saying we should get rid of the thing that was kind of, it's kind of a 1 or 2 decades behind the times anyway.
You know, well, so that's like, little- you know, and along the same lines of false dichotomies, I agreed with Timo Hane, who wrote about nature versus nurture being something that should be done away with. But, you know, even though, yeah, I think that for the most part, scientists today have done away with it. I think there are still things that are being done that at least start from the idea that nature versus nurture is an argument to be had. Like, I've read some studies that have come out in the last 5 years or so that do seem to consider nature versus nurture a serious thing. And I think it's common enough in the public discourse that it's worth bringing up in a thing like this.
Yeah, I guess you're right. I mean, public discourse is always 10 or 20 years behind what's actually happening in the cutting edge of science and philosophy. So,
yeah.
But it's, to us, I think it's like we've been over this. Like, yeah, nature versus nurture is a false dichotomy. The whole left brain, right brain thing is old school. Yeah, this, we're way past this. And interestingly, Eldar Shafir said we need to get rid of the idea that opposites can't both be right. So he's basically saying, got to get rid of the false dichotomy. You know, it's, because often as our knowledge deepens, we realize that, well, neither is completely right or completely wrong. It's just that there's a deeper relationship going on.
Oh, real quick, I liked, Andrew and Cray's talk on Moore's Law, kind of changed my thinking about it a little bit. He thinks that, entertaining this idea or putting so much stock into Moore's Law kind of will have an effect of hurting digital progress in a sense, because people will perceive it as kind of like this linear progression that will peak and then end. And then people are like, oh, what's going to happen after that? And it's not really that simple. It's a lot more complicated than that. And that, this digital progress, as he puts it, you know, will not stop. Well, it probably won't even slow down, even as he says, if one of its strains comes to an end. And that makes sense. And I hope it's true.
Yeah, I agree. I thought that was a provocative answer as well. I do want to mention a couple of our friends of the SGU are in the list. Bruce Hood, the psychologist.
Oh, yeah.
He's been on the show a couple of times.
Oh, he's awesome.
Awesome. He says we need to get rid of the idea of the self. Essentially, like this, that we are the free-willing self, as he calls it. And he acknowledges this idea is on the way out. He knows this is already one of those ideas that's fading away. But
does that mean no more selfies?
No more selfies? I don't
now,
think so.
Steve, right. Could you describe that a little more? I'm not crystal clear on what that is.
So, in other words, like this illusion that we exist as this completely free will entity that we experience as ourself, as opposed to what we think, feel, and do being a result of the functioning of our brain and a lot of the subconscious stuff that goes on.
I look forward to the flood of emails from philosophers that are about to come to us. Massimo is already writing.
The idea that we are driving our own destiny and in total control of ourselves is somewhat of an illusion.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, don't forget environment.
No, not according to many philosophers.
Let me explain it to you better, Evan. Tonight, I ordered, I had to take some work people out to dinner, and I got linguine and clams. And the rational part of me said, don't eat all of that. I had no control over myself, and I ate the whole thing.
Yeah, that's what they mean when they talk about free will.
Yeah.
Thank you. There it is.
Eating clams.
No control.
Our friend Susan Blackmore gave one of the best answers, I think. She wants to get rid of the
neural correlates of consciousness?
The neural correlates of consciousness.
Yeah, I was going to ask what you thought of that.
Yeah, no, she's dead on. In other words, this also fell into a category with which I think a few people did, is there is some debate going on within their field, and they're basically saying that we should retire the other side's idea. You know, like somebody said string theories, you know, that's dead. That was like okay.
Yep. M theory dead.
Yeah, there was a lot of
the idea here is that there's no part of the brain that's conscious. You're trying to find that part of the brain, the neural correlate, that is consciousness. It is
pinpointed.
That seems to be going away as well. That every time someone's tried to put up some kind of theory or some kind of evidence to show you know, the global workspace or whatever it is, that this is the neural correlative consciousness. It turns out not to be true. And the best answer I think we have at this present time is that everything is conscious. The brain is conscious. Every part of it is.
You need the whole thing.
Well, it's not that you need the whole thing, but it's like every bit is contributing its bit to consciousness. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah. Right. So Steve, even if you.
So we found it then.
Steve, the idea is even if you were able to cut out small parts of your brain without killing the subject, right? That you might lose imperceptible parts of your consciousness that you will never be aware of, but you're just not the whole that you were.
Right. That's right. And you generally, when that happens, like if somebody has a stroke and they lose part of their brain that contributes to their consciousness, they're not aware of it.
Yeah. That's scary, isn't it?
Yeah. It's just, it's not part of their construction of their consciousness any further. And so they don't know that it's even missing. Which is interesting.
Yeah, you would need a metaconsciousness to detect it.
Aubrey de Grey, Bob, did you read his?
Oh, I missed that one. Crap.
Science progresses most efficiently by allocating funds via peer review. He doesn't think that
really
the old boy network is doing a good job of allocating funds.
Hmm.
Bob, did you read Roger Schenck? He wants to get rid of the idea of artificial intelligence.
Yeah.
I didn't like what he had to say, to be honest with you.
Yeah. His whole idea was that artificial intelligence will have some utility, but you'll never be able to discuss emotions with your artificial intelligence and all the really, you know, key human parts of our psychology and consciousness. But my big problem with that was that, he's thinking of a machine, you know, he's thinking of like that movie. He's thinking of what I would think of as a robot, a very primitive robot. Oh, the robot will never be able to do the Olympics. Well, yeah, but that's not how it's always going to be. I think it might take a while, but once we create an artificial intelligence that is not only, you know, incredibly knowledgeable, but also incredibly complicated on the level of a human brain or more, then I think it is totally feasible that you could actually have a discussion about things like emotions and with this artificial intelligence.
I had a different take on it. And
okay.
I agree with the points that he's making, although I just think I wouldn't have put it the way that he did. I think what he's saying is that that artificial intelligence research is essentially not moving in a direction that will lead to real artificial intelligence. And I agree with that. That, you know, developing smart systems and expert systems and complicated algorithms and, you know, those kind of things that are what the artificial intelligence field is doing today isn't actually even on the path to a self-aware machine.
Why?
Because it's not just a matter of more complexity, of more knowledge, of more sophisticated algorithms. You need to do something else. You need to actually build something that is designed to be self-aware. But what I think he was not, he didn't discuss, and I think it's maybe because it's not part of what, you know, because he does do research in, you know, computer-based artificial intelligence. I think what probably lies outside of what he's familiar with is reverse engineering the human brain in virtual reality or in a computer. I think when, you know, we essentially have a virtual human brain operating in real time in a computer, that will be artificial intelligence.
Right. And I thought, Steve, I always assumed that we would do that and then make enhancements to that base.
Yeah, maybe.
And that would be the pathway.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah, Steve, that wasn't my takeaway from him. I mean, look at his last sentence, I think. You know, if we want to make more minds, then just reproduce. It's like, really?
No, I'm saying he didn't talk about it, Bob. He didn't go there. He just talked about the fact that what is currently passing for artificial intelligence won't get us there. I agree with him, but I think this other path will. And he didn't even talk about that. That's what I'm saying. Lawrence Krauss, who we've had on the show, will be our keynote speaker at Nexus, which is coming up. The laws of physics are predetermined. You guys read that one? Very interesting.
I did.
There's nothing that means that the laws, there's nothing that says that the laws of the universe have to be what they are.
Right. He said, why not? Why can't they have been just a big accident? Just happened to occur.
Does he lend credence then to the idea that there's like 10 to the 500 universes out there, each with subtly different laws and all that stuff? And
which somebody else wants to get rid of. That's why I think that there were dueling answers here, you know.
Yeah.
Alan Alda chimed in. Did you notice that? He said the notion that things are either true or false is ready for retirement.
Mm-hmm.
Which is an interesting idea, because we have talked about, you know, the inherent complexity of things. Things are not black and white. The things more often than not are shades of gray. And that's a, you know, a more accurate way of probably looking at how things are in the universe. Yep.
Yeah, okay, fine. Knowledge is contingent. Nothing's absolute. You know,
yeah, but
fine.
Isn't that implied in the science-minded individual? It is in my mind. I mean, I don't need to be reminded of that. That's something that should just be taught.
It's kind of like a solipsistic agnosticism kind of thing. Well, you know, we can never be absolutely sure, which I think has merit. I think our main problem as skeptics is that that's not a very appealing point of view. And it's one of the reasons why things like religion and the paranormal and stuff have so much sway, because they seem to offer these solid answers. While all we can do is say, well, it's a bit more complicated than that, to quote Ben Goldacre.
Yeah. Last one before we give our own answers. Our friend Michael Shermer wants to get rid of the idea that hardwired equals permanent.
Yeah.
In other words, talking about like, oh, that's hardwired in the brain, therefore it's something that's unchangeable. He makes the very good point that, you know, our brains actually can learn and change and grow, and they're plastic. And
I laugh because someone else say plasticity?
Yep.
Needs to go away.
All right. Yeah. So much fodder here, but let's go around, guys, and tell me what you would have given as your answer to this question. What is the scientific idea that needs to be retired? Evan, why don't you go first?
So I went with the tired old question, why is the sky blue? And, you know, it was inspired by an email we got recently from a listener. So it gave me some food for thought. So as legend has it, every 4-year-old in history asks this question of their parents, right? And the parents fumble and bumble for some kind of answer, which seems to make sense for both of them. And it's kind of considered one of the first stepping stones of scientific inquiry. But how many children ever got the answer from their parents that sounded instead something like this? Well, Sally or Bobby or whoever, the sky only appears to be blue to you because that is how your brain is interpreting the conditions around you. And, you know, it's, like I said, I was inspired by the question because earlier today we received an email from a listener who felt that the sky should appear predominantly violet to us rather than blue. After all, violet's at the end of the visible spectrum where light waves are most tightly compressed, and as light bounces off things in the atmosphere, such as gases, liquids, and little solid particles, all the things that compromise our atmosphere, or what we call the sky, it should make sense that we would see the most extreme end of the visible spectrum, right? At least during the peak daytime hours. We've talked about it before. The color of the sky is due to Rayleigh scattering, right? Light moves through the atmosphere. Longer wavelengths pass through it, but the shorter wavelengths we can actually see the absorbed blue light is radiated in different directions. It gets scattered, right? This is the scattering effect. And you need to take it a step further. You need to understand that our eyes and our cones in our eyes, right, have a disposition towards blue rather than violet. And it'll interpret a lot of violet as blue. So that's why kind of we see the sky as blue. So I think the question itself and the whole paradigm around the question and it being kind of one of these first scientific questions that a child asks probably needs either some tweaking or, you know, some flat out revision, or hell, let's just scrap the whole blue sky paradigm and concentrate on other first science questions like what color's the grass?
But you can't control what your kids ask you.
Have you considered cages and whips?
Right, but just saying, shut up and eat your oatmeal.
No, I'm just saying there's probably better ways to deal with that, you know, eternal sort of question. So,
all right, what do you got, Bob?
The idea that you know, medieval people thought the Earth was flat, to me it annoys me when people say that. No, the scholars at the time did not believe the Earth was flat. They knew it was round. And I don't care what the average person thought back then. There are people today that don't know the Earth goes around the sun, so it's kind of irrelevant what peasants thought. What did the scholars think? And they knew it was round. And Columbus's difficulty wasn't trying to convince people it was round. It was trying to convince these people that he would actually run into the Indies and not like sail into oblivion, because most people thought that it was too far away, and they were actually right. And if the Americas weren't there, well, he'd never be in the history books. So whatever, there it is.
All right, Rebecca.
Yeah, when I heard the question, my first thought was pop evolutionary psychology. It's kind of an expected answer for me because I've railed about it so much in the past. But the overly simplistic idea that our behaviors are pretty much all due to adaptive traits gained from the Pleistocene era, and that human beings have changed very little since then. And you could also lump in the hooked on Module's idea of the human brain. There's just so much of it that is already outdated, even as it's gaining prominence amongst the Daily Mail crowd. Not only that, but I do think it's actually harmful, because a lot of what it does is, you know, it gets out into the popular consciousness as this idea that some of the simpler ones are just things like, oh, women evolved to like the color pink because berries, you know, things that have been disproved ages ago get out there. And like that one is relatively, not harmful. But then you have these other things like men evolved to rape and, you know, stuff like that. The pop evo psych gets out there while the good rigorous science is still lagging in the rear, trying to point out to reporters like, well, no, actually the evidence says otherwise. So yeah, I would be quite happy to see the most simplistic versions of pop evolutionary psychology retired for good.
Yep. That's a good one. Jay, what do you got?
I think, God, I hope that you guys don't slam me on this. I think we need to get rid of animal testing as part of our day-to-day science. I think we need to start getting rid of animal testing. I think it's time.
How do you recommend
Let's
we
go
do
to
that?
Prison.
Well, it's so easy. Again, it's easy for me to say it, and I know that we rely on it intensely, but I think there are areas of animal testing that we could just get rid of. Like anything to do with cosmetics, just stop doing it.
So you're saying for medical advancement only or health?
Yeah, it's a selfish answer. Yes, I think we should still test animals for medicine-based research because of how important I believe that is. But there's so much that could go away that isn't, in my opinion, important.
Yeah, sir, it's only ethical to slaughter and eat them.
Oh, Christ. Well, see, I know, it's such a hard topic.
I'm not going to give Jay a hard time. No, I think he has a good point, regardless of the fact that he does still consume their flesh.
But it's so tasty.
I do think that there I think he's right. I think that getting rid of animal testing would be a worthy goal and is a worthy goal, and that people are working towards, you know, replacing animal models with other things. I think that technology is going to help here. I think that's something that people are looking forward to in the future. And yeah, I agree. Things like cosmetics testing and stuff like that does need to go away.
Yeah, it's hard not to agree with the notion of eliminating unnecessary animal testing. You know, but you're kind of giving the answer in there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But as long as you acknowledge that, I mean, animal models for medical research are still essential. Sure. Yeah. If it's like saying, yeah, when we could grow our own meat, we won't have to kill animals for it. When we, you know, have sophisticated enough computer models, it'll displace, you know, animal research.
Yes.
But, you know, for the foreseeable future, medical progress is absolutely dependent upon animal models and doing animal research.
I realize that, Steve.
That's why scientists do it, you know, because it's useful. You guys want to hear my answer?
What
do you think? What do you think my answer is?
I have
What would
no
be
idea.
My obvious answer? I'm going to give the most obvious answer for me.
Dualism, right?
Naturalism.
Dualism is philosophically.
I mean, yeah, these aren't really like anyway. Scientific ideas.
All right. I mean, I think anything I would come up with is actually pseudoscientific, but the thing that is, I think that is pseudoscientific, that is doing the best job of posing as scientific and has infiltrated every level of academia and science. And the institutional science is alternative medicine.
Yes.
It has its own journals. It has its own clinics, its own, you know, degrees.
Oh, that's a good one.
It is. It has surrounded itself with all of the trappings of scientific legitimacy, and it is 100% bullshit. The very concept of alternative medicine exists to create a double standard where the rules of science and evidence are on their head, specifically to manufacture the result that is desired by cranks, charlatans, snake oil salesmen, and self-proclaimed gurus.
And it's legitimized by other institutions,
yes,
such as insurance companies.
Absolutely,
right?
Yeah, everything, at every level. Government, insurance, every level, academia. It needs to completely go away. The world would be a much better place if the whole idea, if everyone said, yeah, you know what, this is bullshit, we should get rid of it. There's medicine. There's no double standard. There's just medicine. And either it works or it doesn't work, and we have one standard of evidence to tell us what is likely to work and what is likely not to work. There's no such thing as an alternative. I mean, what, in what other science is there alternative? Is there alternative engineering? Is there alternative physics? No. There's alternative history, but that's bullshit too.
It's so obvious, Steve, and you're so right that it's almost like I have nothing to add. Of course, let's make this happen. That's why I get out of bed in the morning.
Well, geez, we've only been talking about this for decades. It's one of our primary missions on the show and all of our work that we've been doing for the better part of 20 years.
And now we have the Society for Science-Based Medicine if you want to become a member and help in the fight. All right, guys, it's that time again to take a quick break from our show to talk about one of our sponsors this week, GoToMeeting by Citrix.
I really like GoToMeeting because sometimes you can't go to work because the weather is bad and there's snow everywhere. And so you can just go online and talk face-to-face with your coworkers over video.
From the comfort of your home.
Yeah, guys, we're doing an extra show next week, and we're gonna record it on GoToMeeting, and that is such an incredible app. I really enjoyed using it when I was talking with you guys. The video is great. The interface is excellent. It's really something else.
It's so easy to use. I mean, if everyone was able to get up and running on it first time, no problems. I haven't had any other video conferencing app that was that easy to use.
And I keep telling you guys, I use this at work. I've been using it from the beginning. What else do you need to hear? It's awesome. I love it.
Speaking of which, you can start your free 30-day trial of GoToMeeting today by visiting GoToMeeting.com, click the Try It Free button, and use the promo code SGU.
That's right. And if you want to experience it for yourself, you can join us. We're going to be doing this will be our second live video conference. This is actually going to be an extra show that we're going to be recording, where we're just going to be answering listener questions and taking live questions from our live audience. So, send us an email if you want to participate. Priority will be given to SGU members by level. We will take 15 people. It'll be Tuesday, February 4th at 8 p.m. Eastern Time. You will need to have headphones and a microphone, of course.
Yep, and send the email to info@theskepticsguide.org with the subject line, GoToMeeting Live SGU.
All right, guys, let's move on to a couple of news items this week. Bob, you're going to tell us why there are no black holes. So I guess that's an idea that's going away.
Yeah. All right, guys. So here's an example of an out-of-context quote that I found in the titles of countless news items this week. And it makes you think that either a scientist is nuts at best, or that the science itself is so quixotic that you can't rely on anything that they say. So here's a typical bare bones example. Stephen Hawking says there are no black holes. That's pretty much it right there. Gosh. So clearly that's
what the hell's wrong with
that's
him?
That's wackadoo. That's totally, what are you talking about? Black holes, they're not going anywhere, right? I mean,
there's
way too much evidence for them. Clearly there's these supermassive objects all over the place. Thousands, millions of times the mass of the sun in a small space. So what's context was he talking about? So what Hawking was trying to get across was that
he actually said, Bob, there are no black holes in my bathroom. That's what he said.
You nailed it, Jay. What he was trying to get across was that classic black holes, as we've been imagining them, may be different in some fundamental way. That's pretty much it. Specifically, he was referring to the potential non-existence of a black hole event horizon, which has long been thought of as the point of no return, right, around a black hole, mm-hmm. even for light.
Right.
So his precise words were, the absence of event horizons means there are no black holes in the sense of regimes from which light can't escape to infinity. So that's the full quote. So this all stems from a controversy regarding black holes that's been brewing for a bit. For a long time, astronomers ascribed to the no drama scenario regarding event horizons. I remember reading this for the first time, and it kind of surprised me, but it's based on the equivalence principle of general relativity, in that free fall should shield you from the extreme gravity that you would find in many black holes, at least for a while, and such that you would pass right through the event horizon, you wouldn't even notice it, until, of course, you're spaghettified as you get closer to the singularity, of course. But recently, however, scientists have looked at event horizons through the lens of that other mega theory of the 20th century, quantum mechanics. This theory says that journeying through an event horizon would be the exact opposite of no drama. In fact, they're calling it the firewall, because for various reasons involving entanglement, you'd likely pass through a wall of the seething energy that would pretty much fry you to a crisp well before any sort of spaghettification happened.
Hmm.
So this is one of the things that makes black holes, I think, pretty awesome. It's kind of the domain where both general relativity and quantum mechanics both hold sway. And these two theories are both as mind-bogglingly successful as they are incompatible. So fusing them together as one of the holy grails of science, you know, blah, blah, quantum gravity, wouldn't that be awesome? But they don't play together well at all. And you know, this it's one of the reasons why we get those nasty infinities when we try to understand what's going on behind the curtain there. So you can't just ignore the firewall either, and just like kind of just go with the no drama idea. Because if you remove the firewall, you lose something called unitarity, which basically means that the black hole, removes information from the universe. And quantum mechanics says that's a big no-no.
Can't
and
do that.
That was a big problem with the classical idea of event horizon as well. You know, you've got to, quantum mechanics said you can't lose that, you know, any information from the universe. So Hawking dealt with this years ago when he postulated Hawking radiation, saying that black holes slowly emit radiation over time, meaning that they have a lifespan and eventually they will just radiate away into nothingness and some big explosion. So his new idea is kind of an extension of that idea. Event horizons don't exist, he believes, and neither do the firewalls. Security alert. He proposes an apparent horizon instead of an event horizon instead. Now, this doesn't have a sharp demarcation like regular event horizon. Instead, it's kind of a bit fluffier and maybe a lot more chaotic. And it only temporarily, apparently, traps mass or energy, eventually letting it out as energy. And this preserves the information loss. But that this original information that went in is so chaotically scrambled that there's really no practical way to reconstruct it. But I think quantum mechanics is still kind of happy with it. So
yeah, scrambled is okay. Lost is not okay.
Yes. So what are the other scientists saying? Quantum physicist Seth Lloyd of MIT, he thinks that Hawking's idea was a good way to deal with firewalls, but he says it really doesn't address the problems that firewalls raise. I didn't get any more detail on that one. Theoretical physicist Sean Carroll at the California Institute of Technology said, I would caution against any belief that Hawking has come up with a dramatic new solution answering all questions regarding black holes. These problems are very far from being resolved. Okay. Another bummer is that there doesn't seem to be any way to observationally support what Hawking is saying, in the near future at least. So, that stinks. You know, it would be cool if we could just look at black holes and kind of validate what he's saying. It doesn't look possible in the near future anyway. So, but on the other hand, Hawking's insights could lead to a more robust theory of quantum gravity. That could produce testable scenarios. That would be awesome. So needless to say, don't take those news titles at face value. Just dig deeper or just listen to the SGU.
Yeah, I think what's interesting is that black holes present a real theoretical problem for physicists. And they've been trying to work this out over decades. They're making progress, but they haven't. They're a long way from like resolving all of the theoretical issues that black holes raise. The information one was a big one. That was the black hole wars, right? Where Hawking said, "Oh, if you know you guys are right, then information is lost from the universe, which is impossible." Nah, nah. And then eventually they showed how it could all work without losing information, and Hawking acknowledged that
he paid off a bet too.
He paid off a bet. Yeah.
The black hole wars sounds a lot more exciting than it actually is.
Awesome.
I think it's exciting.
It was exciting, Rebecca. It was.
All right.
Sweetie.
No lives were lost in the black hole wars.
But so fewer spaghettified, though. Okay. Rebecca, you're going to tell us about giant underground stones beneath the pyramids of Egypt. It's got to be interesting because it involves Egyptian pyramids.
Aliens built them.
Yeah.
Sorry, did I give it away?
The pyramids spoiler of the stone, alert. Or the giant stones?
All of it. All of
it.
Oh, okay. Yeah, Steve found this video somehow, and I was going to put the kibosh on it because I thought it was very boring at first. But the more I dug into it, the more amusing I found it. So there's this video. It's a guy named Brian Forrester who has appeared on the show Ancient Aliens. Are you guys familiar with Ancient Aliens?
Yes. Oh, yes. Yeah. I turn it off as soon as I see it's on the television.
Yeah.
So very
familiar. Or as soon as you see that guy with the spiked up hair, aliens.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. That's so that's the type of person we're dealing with. Brian Forrester took a trip to Egypt and visited the Serapeum of Saqqara, which is a necropolis near Memphis, Egypt, built around some pyramids underneath the ground.
And Bob, you know what necropolis means?
City of the dead.
Yeah.
Gotta be.
Oh, you were asking Bob.
I thought Bob would find that. I'm surprised he didn't say that's so cool or something. You know, City of the Dead.
Necropolis is an awesome word.
Yeah.
It clearly is.
So this one was built around 1300 BCE, which is when Ramses II was reigning. So this guy is taking a camera around, and the place is open to tourists. This isn't some secret underground cavern. There's a lot of people around, and he's showing these large stone boxes. Each quote unquote box is made of somewhere between 70 and 100 tons of granite. Over the course of the video, he describes them as being variably 50 tons, 60 tons, 80 tons, 100 tons. But yeah, it's a huge mass of granite that they're like coffins. They're like tombs, sarcophagi. And so, yeah, they're very, very large, larger than what would hold the average person. And Forrester and his friends, measure around the boxes, and they find that they are very precise. They are, quote, within a few 10,000ths of an inch of being perfectly flat.
Now, this is the inside. This is the inside.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
The inside is also polished to a mirror-like finish. And he says that the angles are, and I quote, exactly-ish 90 degrees. I listened to this part of the video like at least 20 times to be sure that that's what he was saying.
I thought that's what he said.
He says, yeah, exactly-ish, not 89, not 91, exactly-ish 90 degrees. So.
Oh my God.
And then, text flashes on the screen. This precise to bury a bull? Because that's what historians and researchers say that the Serapeum was used for, was to bury bulls, Apis bulls. And he finds it insane that they would go to all of this trouble to create these beautiful granite boxes to stick some dumb old bulls in. But in fact, he seems to have missed the fact that these bulls were incredibly sacred to ancient Egyptians. The Apis bull cult was one of the very first cults found in Egyptian history. Bulls were considered manifestations of pharaohs. The Apis bull was a deity. You know, they bulls represented strength and virility and determination. So, yeah, they really saw bulls as these deities, as something worthy of worship. And we all know how interested the Egyptians were in spending a lot of time and effort and money on, the afterlife. So it's not exactly surprising that they went to all of this trouble to bury these bulls. And it's also not surprising that they could make a flat surface or angles that were exactly-ish 90 degrees, because the Egyptians have a few of the earliest known texts on geometry. There's the Rhind Papyrus from 1650 BCE and the Moscow Papyrus from around 1850 BCE. So about 500 years before the Serapeum was built, they could already approximate pi and find the volume of a truncated pyramid, things like that. So, yeah. After another five centuries, it's not exactly astounding that they would be able to carve a flat surface and make a corner, a 90 degree corner. So I was interested in what, like, if he doesn't think that the Egyptians were able to do this, and he doesn't think that the tombs were for bulls, I was curious what he thought that they were for. He doesn't say in the video. So I Googled and looked at blogs and forums that were posting the video. And by and large, the answer was ancient aliens.
Of course.
Aliens built them and they were used to bury giants. As we know, there were giants back then. They're in the Bible and everything. Also, speaking of the Bible, there are people who think that ancient angels built them, and that Nephilim hybrids were buried in them. Nephilim being the giant fallen angels who came to Earth and may have copulated with human women.
Well, that makes sense, Rebecca. I mean, angels are very good at math. That's why they call them archangels.
Oh my god.
That's worthy too of much. Me. All right, that's a good place to end it. There you have it. Those are your choices. The Serapia was built by terrible punny angels, ancient aliens, or humans who were about as smart as we know humans are and liked bulls.
Yeah, I mean, why would people go through an elaborate ritual just for their belief system? I mean, come on.
I know. We've never seen
so
that.
Okay,
crazy.
Jeez.
All right. Thanks, Rebecca. Evan.
Hi.
Get us up to date on Who's That Noisy.
Okay. I'll start by playing for you last week's Who's That Noisy as a reminder. So here we go. Ever hear of something called a phonautograph?
That they had those back when they had the auto gyros?
Yeah, well, sort of, yeah. So his name was Edouard Leon Scott de Martinville, and he created the first device back in, the 1850s that recorded sounds, recorded music. He received his patent on March 25th. 1857 for his sound recording device. This is many years before Edison came up with his, you know, cylinder device that also made recordings. But this is the oldest known recording. Scientists at Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory in Berkeley, California, they were able to figure out that these squiggles on these paper were a playable audio file, and they were able to put it all together and figure out exactly what this was and what it recorded. The recording is part of a French folk song called Au Clair de la Lune, which was initially played at a speed that produced a reasonable musical tempo. And on that basis, it was unveiled as a 10-second recording of the voice of a woman or a child, which is what we played. But it was later decided that the playback speed was too fast. It was actually a 20-second recording of a man, probably the inventor himself, singing the song very slowly, and is the earliest known recording of singing in existence. There you go.
Cool.
Good stuff. Good stuff. And thanks to Matt Beckstrom, listener of the SGU, for sending that our way to use. Plenty of correct answers on this one. So a lot of good historians out there doing their homework. Very good job. This week's winner, Jen Che. C-H-E. Jen Che.
Good job, Che.
Now,
this
fresh
week.
Yes, fresh noisy. Here we go.
I'm quite happy to be an atheist because I think actually God likes atheists better. We never ask him for anything. We're not bothering him all the time.
That's a voice that I think some of our listeners might be familiar with. So go ahead, give it your best guess. Send us an email, wtn@theskepticsguide.org, or put it up on our forums, sguforums.com. Good luck, everyone.
Thanks, Evan.
Thank you.
I think we have time to squeeze in one email. This one comes from Ryan Ciuffatelli from Goshen, New York. And Ryan writes, I was recently surprised to learn that my understanding of Mithras debunking the originality of Jesus was fundamentally incorrect. According to this website, he gives a link, at least the New Atheist claim that Mithras predates Jesus is incorrect. I now see that this article is under review as being biased towards Christian apologists. Wherever the truth lies on this particular issue, the article got me thinking, are there any common atheist or skeptic talking points that are fundamentally incorrect, or perhaps presented more simplistically than an honest discussion of the truth ought to be?
I blame that terrible movie. What was it? It was like Loose Change, but for The Secret and marketed towards atheists.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I'm talking about? What was the name of that movie? It was like an online film.
Have you guys heard of Mithras?
Yes.
The character on Babylon 5? Oh, that was Zathras.
No. It's the stuff that Frodo's armor was made out of.
Yes.
That's Mithril. Mithras.
Oh, that's Mithril. Oh.
Yes, it's Mithril with an S. So this is a Roman cult, the Roman Mithras cult. And the common claim is that all of the elements of Christianity predated, Jesus, the time that Jesus was said to have lived, and were elements of the Mithras cult, that he was born of a virgin in a manger, that he had 12 disciples, that he died and was resurrected, all the key elements of the Christianity myth. If true, obviously that would
Zeitgeist. Spirit of the time.
Sorry, that's what it was called. I finally was able to Google it. It's a terrible movie, and atheists bought it hook, line, and sinker. And I think that it's the film that propagated the idea amongst internet atheists that Jesus was a direct copy of Mithras and other gods.
Yeah. I found a YouTube clip of Stephen Fry repeating it uncritically. Ooh. So it's penetrated the atheist subculture.
On QI.
We've lost Stephen? Oh.
QI gets tons of stuff like that wrong, though.
Yeah. Mm. I tried to find as much about this as I could, trying to go to just, neutral, objective, archaeological sources, not people engaged in this debate about Mithras. And it's total BS, is the bottom line. First of all, there was a Mithras cult in Persia, but probably had absolutely nothing to do with the Roman cult. And so the Roman cult is essentially contemporary to and follows Christianity. It doesn't predate it. So in order to claim that it predates it, you have to say it's the same thing as the older cult by the same name in Persia, but it's not. There's no connection there. The actual myth, first of all, there's also no, there's no text, there's no writing saying this is what, the cult of Mithras believes. They've had to reconstruct the mythology of Mithras from iconography on runes, on Mithras worshiping sites. So they're just interpreting pictures. And there are some mentions in contemporary literatures. But this is the reconstruction of what the Mithras cult was, that Mithras was a local hero. He saved his community by slaughtering a bull. Then he brought the bull to the sun god and they feasted on the bull. He's often depicted surrounded by the 12 signs of the zodiac, and that's where the 12 disciples comes from. But there's no indication that the signs of the zodiac have anything to do with people or disciples. He was allegedly born in a cave, not a manger, and he was born out of the rock, not of a virgin.
Most rocks are virgins.
Yeah,
Steve.
That's true.
Point of
so, order. If you just say, all right, there's a cult in the early 1200 AD of a guy who was, born in a cave out of the rock, slaughtered a bull and feasted on it with the sun god. You wouldn't think, oh, that's the, antecedents of Christianity. No modern scholar believes this. It's just, it's basically internet mythology at this point in time. But actually, when I wrote about this, I made the point that fudging the details to try to make it seem like Christianity was lifted wholesale from Mithras is kind of missing a deeper point here, which is worth pointing out, that there were lots of cults. There were lots of mythological beliefs at the time that had similar narrative elements. A miraculous origin, being some sort of savior, the hero, there being some connection to the gods. There's still some uncertainty about whether or not Mithras was the sun god or it was just with the sun god. The same thing, I also made the same point about Horus, because Horus is an Egyptian god, and some people claim that Christianity is also based upon Horus, but again, you have to fudge all the details to make the details the same. Horus was born of his mother, who got pregnant through magical means, from the seed of his father after his father Osiris had died. So again, it's not a virgin birth, but it was a miraculous birth. And as the Horus legend evolved, he became divine. You know, so he was man and divine, and it was all mixed together. And, you know, and he was a savior. And so there's the same narrative elements flow through many of these mythologies, but the details are all different, right? So I think, don't lose the larger point here of, I think, the notion of comparative religions, you know, comparative mythologies, that scholars who study these things, you know, you can see the narrative evolving through historical time.
These sort of armchair atheist historians do everybody a disservice because they put out this stuff, it catches on, and it's so easily debunked that it does the opposite of what they're trying to do. Well, in part, it does what they want to do, which is spread their videos around and make other internet atheists who already are atheists pat themselves on the back. But it doesn't do any good for actually improving knowledge about mythology and about the spread of these cultures, which is really interesting, you know, and sometimes complicated and, you know, a much better story than the crap they're putting out.
I agree that there's nothing worse that a skeptic can do than put out misinformation because it happens to be convenient for the skeptical narrative.
Yeah.
Guys, before we go on to science or fiction, we want to remind our listeners that the Northeast Conference on Science and Skepticism is coming up in New York City, April 11th to 13th.
Oh my God!
And we're all going to be there.
Yay. I cannot wait. I love that convention. It's so much fun. It's close.
Yeah, it'll be great to see you guys again.
I know it was the last time we were all together in the same room.
Yeah, I love doing the show together with you guys. I think the show is so much better when we are all together.
Oh, totally. Yeah. Definitely. Oh, yeah. But a great lineup of speakers this year. I mean, you know, Lawrence Krauss is going to be the keynote speaker for the event. And, you know, he's just dynamite on a stage or in front of a television camera or anywhere. I love hearing him talk.
Yeah, we also got Paul Offit. Heather Berlin is back this year. She was great. We'll probably do another neuroscience type panel together.
Cool.
We got stimulus response again this year. Jay, remember last year we had this. We're going to do this again this year. They had improv actors pull Jay up and like to ask questions about, just ask him some basic background questions. Then they improvised all these skits about Jay's life. And it was hilarious.
Oh God, that was, you know, of course, like D&D came up and then,
being a superhero.
The funniest thing was, like the superhero, what was the superhero name I came with? Dr. Success?
I forget.
that was my superhero name. And, then they did all these skits of my life. And of course, to me, it was the most entertaining thing I had seen that year. So yeah, I loved it. That stimulus response is going to be really awesome this year. I know what's going to happen. Most people don't, but I do, and it's going to be epic.
So stop by nexus.org and register today. Of course, we'll be doing our live show on stage. We'll have our table there. We'll be there to meet and greet all of our listeners. It's always a good time being at these events, and this is a great one. All right, guys, we have to take another quick break from our show to talk about our other sponsor.
Squarespace!
Squarespace.com.
The all-in-one platform. It makes it fast and easy for you to create your own professional website or online portfolio. And right now, you can get a free trial, 10% off your first purchase. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer code SGU1. That's the number one, SGU1.
It's so easy to use, guys, but if you need some help, Squarespace has an amazing support team that works 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. There's over 100 of their Squarespace employees on the customer care team, which is based in New York City.
Did you know that their office has been nicknamed the Care Bear Lair?
I didn't know that.
Terrifying in a way, but I think they mean it to be friendly. But yeah, it starts at just $8 a month, and it includes a free domain name if you sign up for a year.
Occasionally, during our Squarespace ads, we have featured listeners who have their own website made with Squarespace. This week, we're going to talk about Craig Good. He's a friend of ours that we met at Pixar.
Love Craig.
Yeah, he's awesome. He has a website, craig-good.com. If you want to look at an example of what somebody just all by himself did this using Squarespace, he said it was a great and easy experience, and his website is gorgeous. Take a look at it.
And you can do the same. Start your trial with no credit card required, When you decide to sign up for Squarespace, make sure to use the offer code SGU1. Number one, as Jay said, get 10% off your first purchase and show your support for The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
And we'd like to thank Squarespace for supporting the SGU.
All right, guys, let's get back to our show.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fictitious. And then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. Stakes are getting higher every week.
Stakes.
How many has Jay won in a row?
Don't even. Come on.
Four, right?
All of them. Yeah, but don't worry. Who's got any? Come on. Forget it. Come on. Move on.
It's too soon for that.
Well, Steve, obviously.
Yeah. All right. Here we go. Item number one. A team of physicists report that they have, for the first time, created a magnetic monopole in a laboratory. Item number two, researchers find that some children who were born blind can still have significant development of vision following corrective surgery, even as old as 15 years. And item number three, a new study finds that antioxidants speed the progression of lung cancer in mice. Rebecca, go first.
Monopole, they should call it a monocorn, because nobody can ever find one like a unicorn. However, wow. It's the best I could do on short notice. I'm going first, for God's sakes. But yeah, so we haven't found one in nature yet, but I can see them, some physicists making one in a laboratory. However, briefly, it might appear possibly very tiny. But yeah, I can see that happening. Children who are born blind having significant development of vision following corrective surgery, even as old as 15. I mean, I guess it depends on, why they were born blind. Like, was it, there are problems that you can have with your eyes, but it could be like a brain issue. There are several ways to be blind, and there are ways to be legally blind, but not completely blind. So that's believable. But as old as 15 years, that is less believable. And significant development of vision. Like, I can believe they could have, like, slight improvement after that long, but I don't know if they could have a significant development when they're as old as, they've been 15 years without sight, they have corrective surgery, and then significant development. That, I mean, I hope that's true, but that's impressive if that's true. And antioxidants speed the progression of lung cancer in mice. I love that one. I mean, it's terrible.
Like, I love that one.
You don't want it.
We just talked about animal cruelty before. I love it.
I hate mice. No, I mean, I don't want it to be true, but you have to just appreciate the irony of that.
I get it. Yeah. It is funny as hell.
Thank you. So because of that, I'm kind of on board with that. I think it's true. So I'm going to go with the children being born blind having significant improvement. I think that is the fiction.
Okay. Bob?
Synthetic magnetic monopole in a laboratory. That's awesome. I remember reading a few years ago that they actually – I think I talked about it at a Nexus a few years ago. They actually thought they discovered – a magnetic monopole.
I remember that,
I guess,
Bob.
Nothing.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Yeah, I guess nothing really came of that because I haven't heard about it since. A synthetic one would be awesome. I really, really hope that's true. Sounds feasible to me. Let's see. I'm going to jump to the antioxidants. Yeah. I mean, I'm a little hesitant about that one, but not at all like my hesitancy for number two. Come on. You're born blind, 15 years. You know, when those electrical signals start coursing through your optic nerve when you're 15, your brain is like, what is this?
Yeah.
I have no idea what's going on. 15 years, it's safe to say you have missed a significant window.
Wow.
So, on principle alone, I've got to say 15 years is way too old to have significant development of vision. Seeing, yes, but actual stuff that the person knows what it is and can deal with it. No, that's fiction.
Okay, Evan?
I guess the question is, how did they make it? What kind of matter or like what device? Or maybe it's some nanoscale kind of thing, because you can't do
they
it.
They took a bar magnet and broke it in two.
Yeah, you can't do that. That's the whole point. That's the whole point. Defeats that purpose. And so we've talked about things like this before, in which, you know, you shut off, you deprive a baby or something of some of it. You know, for example, you blindfold a baby, you know, after it's born, and you leave it blind for a year, right? You don't take it off. What would happen? Well, I guess the brain, those parts of the brain that are responsible for the vision, like, couldn't develop, and therefore that's it. You can never get the vision back, or something to that effect. Therefore, 15 years, blind children. That one's the fiction.
And Jake.
Yeah, so the one about antioxidants, yeah, it's ironic, to say the least, if that's the case. And then going to the second one about this, you know, this, Steve, I'm telling you, this one about the blindness 15 years. I mean, this is like the 40% last week, like 15 years, like there's no development of that part of the brain. I can't possibly see in any way how this one is true. I just, look, everyone says it. Number two, the blindness thing. There's nothing I can think of that makes that even remotely feasible. I think that you made that up out of whole cloth.
Okay.
He's going to screw us on this.
Bob.
Bob, way to smell a trap 10
Bob,
minutes
Bob, settle
after.
Down. I know, right? Bob, like, so aggressively talked me into that one.
That's good work, boy.
He's going to screw us, Trust.
Okay.
Is it too late to change our answer?
You all seem to be the most sure about number three, so let's start there. A new study finds that antioxidants speed the progression of lung cancer in mice. You all think that one is very humorous science. And that one is...
Not humorous.
Science.
That is science. Antioxidants suck.
What's it doing? How is it helping cancer?
Not necessarily humorous. I don't want people to think that I want people to...
It's ironically humorous.
Steve, which antioxidant?
Vitamin E.
Oh, boy.
And NAC, which is... NAC, yeah, N-acetylcysteine, NAC.
They found out that vitamin E is food for cancer.
The NAC thing they found out just accidentally, because they were using that as a control in another study, and the mice that were getting the control had more rapidly progressive cancer, so they thought maybe it's an antioxidant effect. So they then did a repeat study, and they also added another arm with vitamin E in it, and both the NAC and the vitamin E mice who had lung cancer, their lung cancer progressed more quickly, and they died faster. So this is what they think is going on. Antioxidants, as the name implies, they neutralize oxygen-free radicals, which does cause DNA damage. The reason why there's the whole big antioxidant craze is that by taking more antioxidants, it will reduce oxidative damage to DNA until you'll live forever. But unfortunately, biology is more complicated than that. And part of the cell's response to DNA damage is to mobilize proteins that have a stabilizing effect. By using antioxidants, partly what you're doing is you're reducing the DNA damage. That is true. But you're also reducing DNA damage in the cancer cells. So they actually live longer and
boy,
grow.
That sucks.
Yeah. It increases tumor growth. So
can't something freaking work?
Because the DNA damage also, you know, releases a protein that suppresses tumor growth. So it's a double whammy. The you know, the cancer cells are more viable and they're not being suppressed.
Yeah.
So they grow faster and they kill you quicker.
Bummer.
Damn that complex biology, not adhering to our simplistic models. But this is not the first study to show that antioxidants could be bad for you and can increase cancer. Vitamin E in smokers increases the risk of developing lung cancer in some studies. All right, let's go. I guess we'll work our way backwards. Go down to number two. Researchers find that some children who were born blind could still have significant development of vision following corrective surgery, even as old as 15 years. You all fairly confidently believe that this one is the fiction. And this one is
fiction.
Science.
Oh!
What? Sorry, guys.
But I read the monopole one.
Yeah, too. You read it wrong.
Oh.
So Yeah, this was very surprising because you're not supposed to develop your visual cortex at 15
wow.
years of age.
Wow, surprise.
This was very surprising. This is a study that took place in India. These are children that were born with congenital bilateral cataracts. So they were blind at birth because of really bad cataracts. Now, in Western industrialized countries, children will get operated on very young for this condition because, you know, if you go too long without being operated on, then the thinking is, well, it's too late, you know, for your visual cortex to develop. That window closes, as Bob said. But in India, there are children who are, you know, live into their, into adulthood who never get operated on for their bilateral cataracts. So this was a series. They looked at 11 children that they operated on. And of those 11 children, they did baseline visual testing. They were all blind, but I mean, they did like right after surgery and then a year later. What they found is that five, that's why I said some of the children, five of the 11 children had a remarkable development of vision in the year following removal of their cataracts. But this is in a very specific way. They were looking at contrast enhancement, the ability to see the difference between different shades of gray. Right. So the ability to see.
Oh, geez. I knew you were going to pull some crap like that.
To see contrast. Two of the children, one 11 years old and one 15 years old, had a 30-fold increase in their ability to see contrast. So this was, they were,
so what?
They were able to recognize.
I'm sure, well, yeah, you're right. Yeah, Bob, I'm sure that's nothing to those kids.
Contrast.
So what?
That's significant development of vision.
Yeah.
Contrast.
Bob, that's a significant development. I didn't say it was a development of significant vision. I said it was a significant development of vision.
Oh boy. Totally misleading, dude.
No, it's perfectly cromulent. And
not at all.
The researchers said these children had an improvement in their quality of life. The vision was functional. They were able to recognize shapes and it improved their quality of life. I call that significant. And it's significant because it's not supposed to happen at all. And it was a very surprising.
It's called payback from last week, Ev.
It was not payback. It was a very surprising result, but this is a very interesting study. It showed something that the researchers didn't expect. It was in some children, their visual cortex was able to change even at 15 years of age, which, you know, is not something that's been previously described.
All right. Good for the kids. Get to the last.
Yep. All right. Number one. This means that a team of physicists report that they have for the first time created a magnetic monopole in a laboratory. That one is the fiction. Now,
what they created it in a hut. Representation of that monopole.
Yes.
No, they created it in a basement.
I was like, it's a TP.
What they have done is create a monopole analog. It's not a real monopole. They were very,
they made a drawing of a monopole.
They used some kind of quantum effect to simulate a monopole, but it's not a monopole.
It was a synthetic monopole.
It's not a synthetic monopole.
That's what I read too.
It's
Rebecca.
An analog. Yeah. You read a bad press release.
Ugh.
I noticed you guys threw in the word synthetic when Steve didn't type it in there. I'm like, where are they getting synthetic?
Yeah, that's implied. By laboratory. I posted on the Skeptic Facebook page not 3 hours ago.
Time for a retraction. Ugh.
Oh man, that was not
you have to read deep into several articles before somebody says this is not a monopole. This is absolutely not a monopole.
But now we're just having a philosophical debate over what a monopole is. Maybe it's not your Socratic ideal of a monopole, but I say it's a monopole.
Yeah, the shadow on the wall, Steve. Think about it.
Right. Would you like me to read the exact quote?
No. Continue.
I would.
Look, guys.
Okay.
Guys,
I'll do that for you.
You have to, when you win, you got to take it humbly. And when you lose, don't be a bitch.
When you lose, you got to fight like a tiger.
Here's the actual title of the press release that I'm going off of. I pulled the article itself too, but here's the press release. Quantum cloud simulates magnetic monopole.
There you go.
Well, I certainly didn't read that.
And I also did not read that.
Let me give you the money quote. Stephen Bramwell, a physicist at University College London who pioneered work on monopoles in spin ices, says that the experiment is impressive, but that what it observed is not a Dirac monopole in the way many people might understand it. So there's a mathematical analogy here, a neat and beautiful one, but they're not magnetic monopoles.
Well, Steve, this was a perfect storm of science fiction for you, wasn't it?
You knew.
Hence, number one and number two.
Hence the sweep.
Were perfect to screw us.
Yeah, because last week he threw us a softball and he regretted it all week, so that we get screwed. Whatever.
Jay, I can't manufacture these items. These are the ones I found.
They were perfect. I'll give you that.
All right. Thanks for being
Steve.
Good sports guys.
Mm-hmm. Screw you, Steve.
Wow.
All right. Well, Jay, do you have a quote for us this week?
I have a quote sent in by a listener named Eugene, and this is a quote by David Hilbert. Anybody know who David Hilbert is?
Hilbert Space? Is he a physicist?
David Hilbert was a German mathematician recognized as one of the most influential and universal mathematicians of the 19th and early 20th centuries. He invented or developed a broad range of fundamental ideas in invariant theory, axiomization of geometry,
mm-hmm.
and other stuff. And the quote is, "Sometimes it happens that a man's intellectual horizon becomes smaller and smaller, and as the radius approaches zero, it concentrates on one point, and then that becomes his point of view." David Hilbert!
Thank you, Jay.
So I just want to mention that I did an interview with the Filipino Free Thinkers as part of their fundraising to help with the recent hurricane. You can see the interview I did over Skype at FilipinoFreeThinkers.org.
Hey, and I did an interview too this past week.
All right.
The folks at Kravcast had me on. What the heck is Kravcast? Well, it's a podcast about Krav Maga. Krav Maga Raleigh, as in Raleigh, North Carolina. KravMagaRally.com. Go there and listen. It was fun.
Hey, since we're dropping names, I was on the You Are Not So Smart podcast, a celebration of self-delusion. On January 16th, this was about conspiracy theories. It was a lot of fun. So I guess we'll have the links to all of these in the show notes, so take a listen. All right. Well, thank you for joining me this week, everyone.
Thank you, Steve.
Thanks, sure. Doctor.
I've lost all confidence in my science news sites.
Monopole.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible.